everyone. I am your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. My guest today is Scott Baradell. He is the founder and CEO of Idea Grove, a PR and marketing boutique for B2B companies. The firm is a three-time Inc. 5000 company and a two-time Inc. Best Workplace. Before Idea Grove, Scott was the chief communications officer for $2 billion companies, the co-founder and CMO of a venture-backed startup, and an award-winning journalist. He published his first book, Trust Signals, Brand Building in a Post-Truth World, in 2022, and lives in Dallas, Texas, with his wife and five children. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm great. And I'm so excited to have you on the show today because we're going to dive into the topic of trust, specifically how consumers, everyday people like you and me, can figure out whether companies and brands are trustworthy. In fact, as I shared in the introduction, you wrote an entire book about it. And so I'm curious why you wrote the book in the first place. You started out as a journalist, then became a public relations professional, and now you lead your own agency. What in your career history and personal life made you decide that this book needed to be written?
Well, it was kind of coming at me from two different angles that kind of converged. One was that I had been frustrated as a PR professional, as primarily a PR professional for, gosh, I'd been one for, 20 plus years. And like you, we were in the early days of blogging and PR blogging. And I was like many people who was blogging at that time in the early days of social media. And blog is what built my business. It put me in a position from an SEO standpoint that my little Idea Grove, which 20 years ago was just me.
I remember that.
We were ranking above Edelman and Fleischmann Hiller and everybody else. And so I've started getting into business. All from just being early, like you were, in writing a blog. And there was a lot of optimism among people in PR that because PR was all about organic relationships, it had been traditionally relationships with the gatekeeper of the media, that this would just naturally extend to social media. And so and we thought, the era of advertising, which was kind of the arch nemesis of PR people ever, earned media is better than paid media. Well, we thought we were the natural owners of the future of all this authentic kind of organic communication that was going to be happening through social media. And little by little, we found out we were wrong, often in humiliating fashion. For example, ultimately, all of the money that went into not only social media, but building digital marketing programs all went into marketing budgets, all more likely to be aligned with traditional advertising firms that expanded into digital marketing firms than PR firms. And very frustrating, even things that had always been ours, like reputation management, suddenly because we as PR people weren't savvy enough to figure out the SEO side of reputation management, a whole new cottage industry, online reputation management, emerged and took that away from us too. So the most important piece of reputation management, which by the way, was what started the modern PR industry, was reputation management with Ivy Lee and protecting the railroads from bad publicity. That was reputation management. That's what started modern PR, his declaration of principles and all of that. Even that for the online world got taken away from us. And it was very frustrating to me. And it was like deja vu because having been in the media, I started out as a reporter and was for years. And then I became an executive for a media company. How backwards and, clinging to tradition media was. And PR, having been media's junior partner, really from the beginning, this idea that, we don't have to worry about the end world, end user and consumers and people like that. If we just make buddies in the media, they'll carry the water and take that message out there. And so we had this very myopic idea of just PR is just about relationships with the media. And we didn't want to give up that, just like the media didn't want to give up the idea that people were going to receive a a printed newspaper on their doorstep. So I think we were joined in this kind of very backward and limited way of thinking about what the media was, what PR was, what the dynamic between the media and PR should be. And we got left behind. And so I saw that. Now, like a lot of PR firms, we embraced early on social media, content marketing, digital marketing, all these things.
Yeah, I know you did that. I know you did that with Idea Grove. I saw that back in the early days.
But we, those were never associated with the PR profession. You know, they were like, and even things like web design, which we do, we'd get questions like, and we're not the only PR firm. Well, you're a PR firm. Why would you be doing web design? Well, okay. Well, if you think of a PR firm as someone whose only job is to go get media coverage for you, then I guess that's a good question. If, on the other hand, you think PR firms are about figuring out organically how to build trust with audiences, I'd rather start with that than go with some design firm that has visual pyrotechnics on their site but doesn't truly understand authentic communication. So these are the kind of things that led me. This is a long explanation, but you said we can go as long as we need to. So I will.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Ultimately, what it comes down to is these frustrations piled up over time. And just the things like not being able to connect the dots here, because PR as a profession hasn't done a great job of connecting those dots. So this book is about trying to connect the dots between what PR is supposed to be, what it ended up being, and what it can be and should be now, which is an expanded idea of PR. Because I think most PR people at this point realize that if you continue to tie yourself, anchor yourself to the media and earned media as your only role or your primary role even, you're painting yourself into a corner that's getting smaller and smaller. So that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book to expand the definition of PR. Early on in the introduction of the book, I redefined PR as the art of securing trust at scale. So that's ultimately what this book is about. Let's redefine PR beyond let's make buddies and take media people to lunch and get coverage in some media outlet and call it a day. And let's have this larger goal of earning trust for our clients. And once you establish that as the goal, then you can say, well, we should be the resource that understands how to earn trust better, understands our customers' values, all these. While the marketers worry about how to sell a product, we'll worry about the other things that go into purchase decisions. Because a lot of people today are buying on not just the UVP of a product, but what they perceive as the values of the company. That sounds like a PR thing to me. A lot of audiences are important besides the buyer. Do you think Bud Light was killed just by buyers of Bud Light? No. It was killed by a lot of audiences that got involved in that weren't properly addressed. That's a PR question too.
Right.
So PR as a broader definition of what PR should be, its importance has only increased. But if we don't stake our claim and explain why, then we're going to let all that go to other people to do too and just be in this corner of doing this one thing that gets less and less important. So that whole frustration and irony is what led me to create the book. Now, I know the audience of your podcast is mostly consumers and people like that, but in terms of how that's relevant, the book is, even though that's what drove me to write the book is really full of practical tips of all the ways you can, a small business or an entrepreneur can earn trust, or a consumer can identify who they can trust in a business.
Since we're talking about trust, we also have to talk about truth. And you hit on this, you hit on a couple of definitions early on in your book, specifically in chapter 2, where you talk about Oxford Dictionary's 2016 International Word of the Year. And those folks who might remember this, remember what a big deal was, the word was post-truth. And it's defined as an adjective meaning relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. You comment in the book that, ironically, even this definition is subject to debate because many people don't believe facts are less influential. They believe they simply don't exist. And you make a difference between post-truth and post-trust, arguing that you don't feel we're in a low trust world, just that who and what we trust can vary widely, and that we've merely shifted who we trust. And you also say, quote, the post-truth era has changed who we trust, how we trust, and what makes us trust. In other words, a fragmentation of trust. In my mind, that fragmentation is reflected in things like the coining of the term alternative facts, which entered mainstream conversation in 2017, and it even has its own Wikipedia page in case somebody wants to look at that. And there's also the term speak my truth, which claims a subjective objectivity, if you want to call it that, combining the objective truth with the subjective my. So let's start with a really easy question here. What do you see as the interplay between facts and truth?
Between facts and truth? Well, in a fragmented society like ours, there's enough facts out there freely available. Just try ChatGPT. Well, it won't always be. Sometimes hallucinations. Let's just say Google it. But you can find a lot of facts to support any argument. And there's a lot of voices out there. Sometimes, particularly in the media, they seem like a lot of voices, but they're all owned by a few companies. But there are a lot of people out there, a lot of voices out there expressing opinions, and you can always find facts. And what separates fact from perceptions of truth is that we all choose and curate the sets of facts that help us to make an argument. And that's not necessarily a deceptive or bad thing, in that we all have to do that. You know, in learning American history, you know, and I was a U.S. history major in college, and history was always my favorite thing. And there's a lot of history in the book probably as a result. But, you know, no matter how many hours of class you have to study history, you can't learn all the facts.
Right.
And the ways to look at the facts. And so, for example, let's look at it this way. I can't remember what if this was Bill Mayer or who had said this, but they were saying that they asked a kid like what they knew about George Washington, and they said, well, he's a slaveholder. He was a slaveholder, and they didn't know anything else. Whereas, you know, you could have grown up in the era I did, and you could learn all kinds of things about these are the fathers of our country, and it was okay to say fathers then, and a lot of things that were different, and things like slavery, and what happened to Native Americans, and these things that were horrible parts of our history, they were kind of put to the side, right? Because it was the idea was we want to create American patriots. That's a goal. We're trying to galvanize people around the idea that they should be proud to be an American. And that used to be a mission of schools. And you can argue, well, wait a minute. I'd rather read, you know, the people's history, you know, something that doesn't, you know, change or curate the facts around this goal of creating good patriotic citizens and spends more time on the other things. And now you have, you know, something like 1619 Project, which was fascinating. And basically saying you could also look at all of history through the experience of African Americans from the time they first arrived here.
Right.
And kind of build a whole story around the country centered around that. Now, my personal opinion, I loved the 1619 Project, but I also thought it helped me a lot in terms of how my appreciation of it, that I've studied so much history and read so much. If I just got the experience that way, so many important things would be left out. So that's really what we're talking about everything online. It's like there are a lot of facts. You know, Kellyanne Conway got ridiculed when she first talked about introduced this term alternative facts, because I think it was around a silly topic like the Trump saying they had there were more people who watched his inauguration than there were, right? But the truth is, alternative facts are a real thing. The mainstream media decides which facts it wants to use. Alternative media, which is, say, to the left of mainstream media, and conservative media to the right of mainstream media, they use their own sets of facts. I mean, Amy Goodman in Democracy Now! Is not using the same sets of facts that MSNBC is using, which is not using the same sets of facts that Fox News is using. All of them are facts. So that leaves people frustrated and distrusting of the media and looking for ultimately finding that set of media that seems to align most with what their gut was already telling them or what they had already learned growing up and things like that.
Isn't it also a question of not just the facts, but also whether there is truth in something? In other words, if we see a set of facts and I selectively pick them to support my argument or my viewpoint, that's one thing, right? And if I, you know, it can be defended or not defended. But if I'm fabricating information or I'm really misinterpreting something that I know isn't the case, that doesn't seem to be a question of different facts. That seems to be a question of honesty or dishonesty or delusion and its implication for, going back to our topic today, trust, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of people clearly in the media, online, everywhere, take certain facts and use them to manipulate all people they're reaching, and they leave out a lot of things intentionally, trying to deceive or guide their audience in a less than honest way, and that happens all the day, all the time, every day, and that's a real thing, and that's something that is can be difficult to ferret out, because typically the people that are the audiences are it's things they want to hear. The facts that aren't being shared are the facts that they don't want to hear. I'll tell you that, we had, and it's one of those things, like, as Joni Mitchell said, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. We had an incredibly precious and valuable American consensus after World War II. We were by far the dominant power in the world, and we had a consensus around what was our worldview. It helped that we had an enemy like Russia, right, like the USSR at the time, to kind of make things very simple. It's all about good and evil, and we're good. So if we have to do things like go into Korea or Vietnam or things that are morally questionable in themselves, at least they go back to this whole poles of good and evil, and we're good. And so you had a foreign policy consensus that lasted until very recently, even after kind of the domestic policy consensus kind of fell apart. And now the foreign policy consensus, gradually since the Cold War ended, has fallen apart for that reason. So let's look at one issue that obviously is being in the news a lot, which is Israel and Palestine and Gaza. This is fascinating to me, because that was one of the last pieces of the post-World War II American consensus. We always supported Israel. And the people that did not support Israel were considered extreme, small minority. Both parties, the media, It was very much Israel was kind of like the UK, one of our closest allies, and that's changed, and it shocked a lot of people how quickly that has come to the surface. And the truth is, all this time since World War II, when we were shown all the reasons why Israel is great in the Middle East and the only democracy in the Middle East, and all these great things, and why they're our closest friend, and why during the Cold War they protected us, and why they're still a buffer against terrorism, all those things. Those were the messages the mainstream media was telling us. Well, now we're hearing more and more about you know, is this apartheid? I mean, this is what Jimmy Carter called it years ago. And Jimmy Carter, a saintly figure as he's become in recent years, was, you know, attacked for using that word, peace, not apartheid. Right. But, mm-hmm. And so, but now that's where they talk about the Overton window of what's allowed, you're allowed to talk about. We've seen how that's dramatically changed. And are the facts different? I mean, the Middle East has been the Middle East for a long time. This has happened for a long time. The facts in terms of what is presented by the media, what is the consensus versus what are the points of view that have to be served, it has widened. So now we're hearing more about the Palestinian side of this conflict than the mainstream media ever gave us to hear years ago. And I think, you know, we talk about the days of Walter Cronkite and this, everyone loved Waltie, it didn't matter your politics. That's just little by little just kind of been blown apart. And I think people are left with a lot of confusion. The media probably doesn't know. They're in a lot of turmoil about how to cover the Middle East right now. And that's just the latest example. This has happened time and time again in a big moment. And the reason post-truth was introduced as a term in 1992. That's when it was coined by a playwright named Steve Tesich. And it became a word of the year right after Trump was elected, because that was this huge moment where I think so many things that maybe Trump is not my favorite person, but what has happened is it was like a light coming on and all the cockroaches scurrying. It's revealed so many ugly things or things that maybe we didn't want to face or realize about ourselves, starting with the people who would support Trump. But not only that, but wait a minute, is this whole idea of we stand up for the national anthem and we all support the same country and we all share some core values, is that reality, or is that something where we're painting over reality? So at least people in general, I think it's true of young people, just in general, feeling way more uncertain. So we can say truth is always good, but the way truth is put out there now in so many different forms with so many different versions, it can be scary. So one of the things the book talks about is how people, as a result, they don't trust their government anymore. They don't trust the media anymore. They don't trust Edelman, the big global PR firm that does a survey of 30,000 people every year. It shows they don't even trust nonprofits anymore. They trust businesses. Which in the 70s, you would have thought, wait a minute, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard, that people would trust businesses most.
In your book, you say one of the things that people should be on the lookout for is what you call trust signals. And so in a business context, you define these as anything that inspires confidence in your brand, in the mind of your customers, employees, investors, and the general public. Trust signals can be planned or unplanned, organic or paid, direct or subliminal. So what kind of things specifically should people be on the lookout for when they're wondering whether to trust a company or the brand?
Well, yeah. So we've set up the bigger picture context of why there's so much uncertainty. And there's uncertainty in who do I believe about Israel and Palestine, who's right, who's wrong. But there's also what product should I buy? And this book is ultimately a marketing book and a branding book, and it's to companies. And so the point I make is these issues touch every brand now. You can't escape it, as Bud Light found out, right? When they thought, oh, well, their sales had gotten flat. They were number one selling beer, but they were flat. So new marketing person tried to shake things up. Let's do some things to appeal to younger people, who are the people that weren't buying Bud Light. And so they partnered with Dylan Mulvaney, a transgender activist, and a lot of the existing base who were older, who were more conservative. They boycotted, and the beer has been tanking ever since. So it just kind of, that's just a big picture to show how these issues, they affect brands now.
And absolutely.
And that's reality. So let's look at it from the standpoint of a consumer and how a consumer figures out how they're going to trust a brand and want to do business with a brand. The book talks about a continuum of influence, which is all the different ways that we are influenced by third parties to choose to purchase a product or a service from a brand. In other words, the least likely place is the content the brand shares itself, because we're just much more likely to trust what other people say about you more than what you say about yourself. So the example I give in the book is someone who worked with us for years, who is as an account person named Lori, and she was looking for a crib mattress for her first baby. So they wanted a crib mattress for their nursery, she and her husband, but they'd already decked out the nursery and they'd gone way over budget, and they still hadn't bought the crib mattress. So they decided, let's just get something cheap because we are way over budget here. And she was planning to do that. And just as she was about to make this purchase, she thought of something she had seen before she had even gotten pregnant, which was an influencer on Instagram who was talking about mini crib mattresses have a problem with toxicity, and that you needed to look at that and buy one that was safe or non-toxic. So she Googled it. She couldn't remember, I think maybe she remembered the influencer, she couldn't remember the brand, but she Googled safest crib mattresses or terms along those lines. And in the first couple of results, boom, there's that brand there. She recognized it. Once she did that, then she did some research and found a bunch of reviews, positive reviews about this brand, 5-star reviews saying how great it is. Then she came across this certifying organization that was certifying things for being environmentally friendly and things like that. Mm-hmm. And this brand had been awarded this seal from this third party organization. And then she finds some Olympic gymnast, in this case had been, I think, hired by the brand, but she also had an affinity for this gymnast and didn't think the gymnast would endorse something they didn't believe in because they talked about how they used it for their own baby. So all of these things combined led to them spending, you know, more than twice as much as they planned to on the crib mattress and busting their budget even more. But, you know, what's one of the most important things that moms want to feel when they're bringing their first baby home is they want to feel like they've done everything to keep the baby safe. So all of it played to that. But the point is, all of these were third party sources of validation that together. Oh, I forgot the last piece was that there were media mentions too. She found a parenting magazine where they had said good things about this crib mattress. All right. Mm-hmm. So what I tell PR people, so there's two audiences here. For the consumer, that's what consumers do. And so if you're a brand, if you're an entrepreneur or a small business, you have to lay these little breadcrumbs of trust that people can follow to come to your website and say, hey, I'm hearing lots of good things about you from all these different places. But as a PR person, what I tell them is, okay, so if all you're doing is getting the parenting magazine placement, do you really think that's going to be enough to convince her to buy the crib mattress? It's right. Not. So why do you limit your role to that one little thing? I forgot to even mention it when I was just sharing the story this time. It's all the things. So what I talk about in the book is there's a real commonality between all of this. It's all about authentically earning trust, whether it's through online reviews or influencers or certifying organizations or media. And all of what we need to do as PR people is identify all the ways that you can, that a specific brand can best engender trust, and then find out the audience you need to reach, because you can't reach everybody, certainly not through all these different ways. And so from the consumer standpoint, it's just the flip side of that. That's the process which people are using to figure out what brands they can trust to buy today. In addition to, I should add, on top of that, for a lot of consumers today, it's important, particularly for younger consumers, to feel like their values align with the brand. In addition to the review said the product works right, if I'm buying this product, am I supporting a company that aligns with my values? You know, today we know that people aren't going to church like they used to. All right. A lot of the things that we that were really important to our society historically in terms of being those anchors are gone. And people are looking for new ones. And I don't go to church. I can't trust my government. I want to feel like there are institutions that I can, I feel like my vote doesn't matter, right? All of that. But if I can align with a brand who is doing things that I support, even in a small way, oh, I buy a pair of shoes so that they give a pair of shoes to someone who needs it, those kind of things, then I feel like I'm actually doing something positive. And in an environment where there's such a void there compared to what it's been historically, those little things become big things. They're really important to people.
Yeah, there's no question that nowadays people are, a lot of consumer spending is based on values. Not all of it, obviously cost matters as well, or practicality, but values are definitely tied into that. And that makes me think of a quote by Nietzsche, which says, "I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on, I can't believe you." And that encapsulates the understanding that trust is one of the most important elements in relationships, whether personal or professional. So what do you do when you've placed your trust into a company or a brand, or want to, and then you find out that they broke your trust? How do you hold them accountable? Can you hold them accountable?
Well, it's something called cancellation.
Okay, well, yeah.
Well, I'll give you an example that happens here. You know, Kevin Spacey just did his first interview, I think, since 2017 the other day. I saw it. It's all over TikTok. And, you know, obviously he made mistakes and did things that were wrong. But he's saying that he just feels like he concedes it. But it's like, does it mean I never get to act again? Because it's been 7 years and he hasn't had a part. It's a good question. You know, is it a death sentence in terms of your career because of what's happened? I mean, he was found not guilty on all charges. So in terms from a legal standpoint, there's nothing there. So it's all about how people feel about things that he did or didn't do as related to the Me Too movement. Point is just that we live in an era, and I guess it's always been this way. It just seems they're more extreme now, of these kind of pendulum swings. Obama is a pendulum swing. At the time, I didn't think of it as such. I thought of it as progress. But after Trump is elected, whoop, you know, there's a pendulum swing the other way. And then when it swings back, it's not many of the things that Obama thought were way too extreme in terms of public policy positions are now mainstream Democratic positions. So it didn't. So, you know, Biden's policies, if people think of him as this kind of doddering old man, which he may or may not be, but the policies that he's aligned with, because that's where the Democratic Party is, are far more liberal, progressive, whatever you want to call them, left, whatever you call them, than Obama's ever were. And we see this going back and forth and back and forth. If Trump wins this next time, who knows how far it's going to go the other way? It's a little scary to think about. So where was I going with this? So the point is that, I was going to talk about a local example here in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our biggest local, advertising firm, it's been around for many years. My wife, Kathy, had worked there years ago, called the Richards Group. They're one of the, I guess, the biggest in the Southwest, or have been. And big, you know, they did the Eat More Chicken campaign with Chick-fil-A the cow saying Eat More Chicken with Chick-fil-A. I will leave a light on for you from Motel 6. A bunch of these kind of iconic campaigns, legendary, and then led by this guy named Stan Richards, who had been leading it for 50 plus years and was in his, I guess, late 80s at that point. And he said in a Motel 6 campaign meeting he was shown some ads about a campaign that was around, it was related to diversity. And according to him anyway, he said, when he saw it, he said it was too black. And he used the term too black. How he's explained it ultimately later was that what he meant was he was expecting to see more variety of people from different backgrounds as opposed to being mostly African Americans. And but someone internally within Richards Group that was on this call where Stan Richards was weighing in immediately shared this with Motel 6. And it was shared in such a way that it came back that that same day, Richards Group was fired from this account mm-hmm. they'd had for decades. Mm-hmm. Not only that, it immediately goes into the trades, all the big advertising trades, as well as local media, that the founder of Richards Group had made a racist remark. And that's something that changed with Trump's election. Before Trump's election, the media, the mainstream media, would not say, unless it was super, super obvious that someone had made a racist remark. They would say things like someone had made a racially charged remark. They would say something that someone had made a controversial racial remark. They wouldn't say racist. And so what happened after Trump, and it started during the Trump campaign, was there was this debate among the media. Are we enabling Trump's lies by not calling them lies? Is it too weak to even call them a misstatement or whatever? And so things like concluding, he's a liar, he's lying, he's a racist. By the end of this campaign and when Trump became president, suddenly for the mainstream media, it was okay to say all those things. And so all this trade media comes out and say Stan Richards is racist for saying the Motel 6 campaign was too black. And he 40% of their clients left within a few days, and Stan had to fire himself, basically, as he put it, and put out an apology that later became clear he didn't really mean, because in his mind, he was just trying to provide a critique. He said, maybe if I had just, the truth is, and it's hard to argue with this, if he had just worded what he said in a different way, and then maybe not so bluntly, or maybe could have been a little more sensitive about how he said it, then he wouldn't have fired himself and they wouldn't have lost 40% of their business. But those are the kind of consequences that happen today, sometimes very much deserved, right? I don't want to suggest that this idea of canceling is companies or brands or people is just always bad, because it can be exactly what's deserved. But it can be, you know, it can be that whole idea of the pendulum goes really big one way and really big the other way. But that's what people tend to do today. To go back to your original question, is when they don't like something or when they feel deceived by a brand, particularly when they had trusted before, it's almost like being jilted by a boyfriend or girlfriend or something. You get mad and you take revenge in social media. You get indignant about it. And there are all kinds of ways, if you can, particularly if you have a little clout online, that you can really do some damage to a brand that you feel has done you wrong.
Right. So, I mean, you make some really, really good points about having to be aware of the power of holding individuals and companies accountable, but then also tempering that with a sense of fairness. You know, is the punishment that we're trying to mete out commensurate with the harm done or the evil done or things like that? Or should they even be held accountable? Was it a misunderstanding? And these are very real life matters, as you shared some of the examples about. And I do see them every day happening. And in some cases, I'm like, yeah, so-and-so, you know, they did exactly what they were accused of. Good riddance. And in other cases, it's like, well, things are a little bit more gray. And that doesn't mean you give somebody get out of jail free card, but it means that you don't necessarily have to, you know, blow them off of the face of the earth. Give them a chance to rehabilitate. And the question of rehabilitation is something that is messy and hard. And so a lot of folks, they just don't want to deal with that part. But so let me ask, if somebody is thinking about pursuing an entrepreneurial path themselves, right? They're somebody, they've always had an idea about a dream business or want to go out on their own. What do you see as some of the emerging trends or challenges in the realm of business trust that they should be aware of right from the get-go to get things started off on the right foot?
So if you're starting a new business, and we actually have, we work with kind of bootstrap businesses and new businesses, and we had a prospect come to us this week, in fact, and they've got a new business starting. A really cool concept, by the way. I guess I shouldn't share it, but
not just yet.
it's in legal tech, and it's very cool. Since you have an interest in that area, maybe I'll tell you about it after. But
yeah,
basically, they want to do PR. They already had PR firms, you know, who've quoted them. Hey, yeah, we'll do your PR and stuff. And I said, well, wait a minute. You don't have a customer yet? And your website doesn't look very good. And so I could in good conscience start doing PR for you because I'm going to have a very poor success rate. So what I would say an entrepreneur is the surest and easiest path to earning trust is through third-party validation. And the single best way to get third-party validation is by getting a referenceable customer. And so if you get that, even if that first customer or two are maybe give them a super good deal, heck, if it, depending on what it is, give it to them free in return for an endorsement, a testimonial. Like a great example of a company that ended up, this was a talk about entrepreneur. This was a friend of mine now named Sanjay Sate, who he's done three successful startups now. He lives in Silicon Valley, but he started out here in Dallas, and he had, if you know, I don't know how popular they are today, but it used to be that this job site, The Ladders, was popular. This idea of these kind of six-figure job sites, that was one of the first ones, if not the first one. And because this was back in, say, 2008, he wanted to have a competitor to that with the idea that they would be better than The Ladders because instead of just giving you six-figure job opportunities on a job board, they would curate them. They would serve you only the things that you wanted and that were the best fit for you, using at the time a team of people in India. So that was the model. So he spent all this money on Google Ads and things like that to try to take this kind of consumer product to market and got nowhere with it. I was got very few customers. The cost per acquisition was huge. Then he had the idea to turn it into a B2B product. And what he decided to do was take everything that he had built, as kind of the engine of the service. And instead of selling it directly to consumers and competing with job boards and things, he would compete with in this much smaller space that was kind of lazy and behind the times a little bit, like most HR services were then competing with outplacement companies like Right Management, Challenger Gray, companies like that. He said, let's turn this into a B2B product where I can go to big companies, companies that are going to have a 2,000 person layoff. And part of what they do is to make, you've seen Up in the Air, maybe the George Clooney movie where from a few years back, where he kind of gives people their packages when they're laid
right.
off. His job.
Right.
Kind of like this idea of how one thing that especially large companies do when they have a layoff is they give them something, a outplacement package to help them find their next job, resources like that. So using this kind of system that he had, which is more tech savvy and efficient than what the traditional players were doing, he could go to big companies and say, I've got a really cool outplacement alternative that's going to cost you a lot less. Mm-hmm. And that's disruptive to the market. And you need to be on the front end of this train kind of thing. And of course, he was starting from zero, but he was able to get interest from the head of HR at a Fortune 500 company based in Dallas. And he developed a great relationship with her. Obviously, you know, not only she ended up being using the product, I think they got to use it for a long time for free to try it out. They rolled it out across their whole company. She ended up being on the advisory board, right, of the company, lots of other things. But man, getting that first referenceable client, this was a company that was having a hard time, had just changed its business model, had no customers. They were able to get that one customer. We used her everywhere, all right? Her face was everywhere. And it was a sincere endorsement. They rolled this out across the company. It was very successful. They're still using it today, all these years later. So it helps to have a good product, right? But you could have been out there, you know, scratching around, you know, for forever. But focus on getting that first customer or two, and then you can build everything from there. You know, you've got to turn that into testimonial videos. You've got to ask them to leave reviews on review sites. Maybe upgrade that to a customer who can be a customer ambassador because they have more of a audience on social media, or you can begin to work with influencers who try a product out. For entrepreneur, those things are most important. I'd say they're more important than getting media coverage early on. Once you start to have those things, then you've got some good ammo for getting the validation of media coverage, like your trade media or technology media or whatever media is going to be important to your audience.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's very accurate. And to your point, you don't necessarily have to have a big budget to do that. What you have to have is a willingness to reach out to folks, work with them. And as you said, maybe even give them a trial run or do some pro bono work and say, look, I'm going to let you test this out. If you sincerely believe that my product, my service is adding value, then I would love to have you say something about that positively that then I can share with other people in the field that can benefit from it as much as I hope you're going to benefit from it. So it's like a win-win for everybody around. And yeah, it does take a little bit of time, but it is, again, the trustworthy aspect of saying, well, wait a minute, you're not paying somebody to say something nice about me. It's they're sincerely saying that based on their own experience. And so that's great advice. And I hope everybody listening to this does that if they haven't done it already. Do you have any advice for what all of us can do at the grassroots level to build trust and thereby build up the environments in which we live?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, one thing that's kind of cool about the concept of trust signals is they don't just apply to business. They apply to every aspect of your life. I mean, if you think about it, when you go look for a job, you're going to check out a company's Glassdoor reviews in deciding if you want to work there. They're going to be looking at your resume, your LinkedIn, and you're obviously going to make that look as good as you can. Those are examples of trust signals. If you go on a date, if you're single and go on a date, hopefully single, but go on a date.
Yeah, we're not that kind of show. Definitely single. No, none of that. I'm not even going to mention the website because I'm not trying to encourage anybody to do it. Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. That website for married people.
There's a new documentary on Netflix about that.
Oh, but dear. All right.
In any case, if you go on a date, people Google each other now, obviously. And that's just how it is. And so people think about how they are, what does my social media presence look like? What does it say about me? In terms of personal relations, there's an old saying that has stuck with me that I think is true. That is, if you always tell the truth, you don't have to remember what you said. And I think that when you're in contact with people and, you know, we notice when they're inconsistent. Sometimes people would rather be, you know, it's one of the things that made Trump so successful is that one of the things we hate about politicians pre-Trump, that we also dislike in individuals in our neighborhood or just in our social circles is people that seem like either they're two-faced or that they'll just say anything to make, you know, to get by. So the classic politician interview pre-Trump was, I'm going to adhere to my party line, but I'm going to try to talk about it in such a way that, you know, everyone can feel like I'm listening to them and responding to them. So George Bush comes up with compassionate conservatism. If you look at the debates between Bush and Gore leading up to that first 2000 election, also a contested election, there wasn't a lot of difference in what they were saying. You know, there really wasn't. Now, the policies behind them were radically different, but they were both trying to kind of appeal to everyone. And if you looked at interviews that politicians have done up till Trump, there was this idea that I'm not trying to piss people off here. I'm trying to get more people into my tent, even if I have a very extreme set of policies that I'm endorsing, like give certain people all the money. I'm going to try to make this look like a win-win for everybody. Trump said, screw that. And I'm going to say the same thing every time. And when people tell me that I shouldn't have said what I said to Access Hollywood, or I shouldn't have done this, or I shouldn't have done that, I'm going to double down every time. And people will forgive the fact or not even notice the fact that I'm actually not being consistent or lying in terms of things like, no, there weren't Muslims standing on rooftops in New Jersey cheering as the World Trade Center came down. This is the kind of early lies these are just, let's call them unverifiable statements. Okay. And completely unverifiable. They went through TV news clips and stuff for that. And it never happened, but he never backed down from it. He never backed down from the Central Park Five, the individuals who were accused of a gang rape. It's the 80s. All right. They were many years later exonerated by DNA evidence, but he would not say that his full page ads that he bought, that these kids should get the death penalty, that was wrong. That's just his thing. So all that is to say, people love, his supporters love that he doubles down, that he is consistent in terms of, I am going to say this, and I'm going to say it over and over again, and I'm not ever going to say I was wrong, and I'm not ever going to back down. And there's an element of that. While many people don't like Trump, there's an element of that in terms of our personal relationships, where we are attracted to people who are strong and consistent in that way. So I think that, you know, ideally you're doing it in a way that doesn't alienate people, but people don't like when you say one thing one time you talk to them and another thing the next time. And that's kind of a lesson from a positive lesson, I guess, from Trump's success. You can't, if you're someone who doesn't like Trump, you can't just look at it and say, this is just a bunch of terrible people voted for a terrible person. Well, that's not true and incredibly simplistic. There's more to it. So let's look at the reasons and maybe we can learn from it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of valuable advice in there. And I do want to encourage people to read your book. So can you share where people can find your book and then also how they can get in touch with you if they need professional help from your agency?
Yes, the book is called Trust Signals, Brand Building in a Post-Truth World, and it's available at Amazon. If you just go to Amazon and Google Trust Signals, it'll be the first thing that pops up. I also have a website, trustsignals.com, and you can purchase the book from there. I have an agency, PR and marketing firm. We just work with B2B clients, mostly in technology, manufacturing, and logistics. My firm is called Idea Grove. Idea like a good idea and grove like an orange grove. And you can go to ideagrove.com if you want to find out more about what my business does. Great. Or you can look at all the Google reviews and other reviews online and just not go to my website and find out about us that way.
Yeah. Apply what Scott was explaining to you today to his agency, and you'll see he's the real deal. And to all the listeners out there, if you enjoyed today's conversation with Scott and want to know when new episodes of the Ready Living podcast are released, just send a quick email with the subject line podcast to team@readywhenstuffhappens.com, and I'll make sure you're notified as soon as they drop. And finally, Scott, thank you so, so much for taking the time today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.